Here we uncover the traditions that are working for successful parents. For the parents who are ready to do things differently but aren't sure how, go to WandaHoward.com and download my free blueprint. It will help you create the difference you've been looking for and enable your kids to be emotionally healthy and confident throughout their lives. Now is the time to start doing things differently. Welcome back, everybody, to the Successful Parents Podcast. I'm your host, Wanda Howard, and today we are missing my co-host, and it's been bittersweet. She is enjoying some time with her dad on a family trip, along with her siblings. Only reason I'm not there is we happen to have 9 puppies just barely born, and so I'm here taking care of them, but it's exciting times. So today we have with us an exciting guest, Greg Goodhart, and he is a learning coach. And so I'm really excited to dive into his story. So welcome, Greg.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here, Wanda.
So first, a learning coach, that's very unique. I haven't heard too many people use that headline. So tell us a little bit more about what you do as a learning coach.
Well, it's the one thing we're not taught in school. We're taught what to learn. We're not taught how to learn it. I know because I went to school and we were all given assignments, and then we were sent home to figure out how to best do those assignments. We were sent home to study for tests on our own with at best a little hint or tip here and there. Here's how you should study. Maybe you should try this. No actual instruction there where you do it over and over sequentially. You teach someone how to learn. And then we wonder why some people do really well and some people don't. That's the reason, because we learning how to learn is a separate skill from content. And we just haven't figured that out yet. And so I started to realize that we just even easy things, like how many of us have gone into a test, whatever grade in school, I don't care if it's graduate school or first grade, and thought, yeah, I got this, and then got a 57. Or a 67, or whatever it is. There's no reason for that to be happening. There's most of the cases, for instance, of testing anxiety can be mitigated a great deal or eliminated, unless it's a legitimate psychological disorder for which I encourage everyone to get professional help. But a lot of it isn't. A lot of it is knowing this stuff and then going into the test and you can't find the stuff. That's just one small area. It's called retrieval practice. You can actually practice retrieving things so that you'll remember anything that you want when you want to remember it. And nobody taught me this. I couldn't believe it. And that's just one little thing. I think we've heard about deliberate practice, flow, spacing, things like that, contextual interference. And I was blown away when I started to discover these things and realize that there's pretty much nothing standing in our way from getting anywhere we want. And it's not nearly as hard as we think it is.
Yeah, well, I love this idea of just breaking down the bounds of learning. This is something that's very dear to my heart and my own educational path. So I'm curious, like, what ages do you typically work with?
Somewhere between 0 and 106.
Perfect.
They have to be a little bit older than 0 and maybe a little bit younger than 106. But other than that, we're good.
Oh, that's perfect. So
learning, can I just on that, just
yeah,
really
quick, go ahead.
We should be teaching this to our kids starting in kindergarten or at least first grade. The same way we teach reading and writing. We don't teach them to read Shakespeare in first grade. We teach them to read See Spot Run. And we should teach learning in the same way. This is something known as cognitive load theory. You reduce the cognitive load. That is, you're not trying to learn Shakespeare in first grade. You're trying to learn nouns and verbs. You probably don't even know what they are yet, but you're learning how to read. We should be teaching learning in a sequential and repeatable iterative way all the way through school. This is available to anyone, and we're not. And it's largely because our schools of cognitive science, which is where these answers are, and our schools of education are siloed from each other. Teachers don't know this stuff. I didn't either. I taught high school for 13 years and college and junior college. I even taught at a Montessori school for a while, and I never knew any of this stuff.
Yeah, it's very interesting to see the difference of somebody going through the whole educational system, fully believing in it, just to come out at the other end and be like, it's broken because it's It's very true that even though we could be learning a whole bunch of different facts and different things cramming into our head, if we don't have this ability to pick something in our own mind, to imagine it, to create it first and be like, I want to know more about that. And that's exciting to me. And then being able to pick up a textbook and being able to decipher like what comes next. And that excitement, I think, is part of that retaining piece that you talked about.
Critical thinking. You're describing critical thinking, which is essential for learning. And I don't care what you want to learn. If you want to do bad things like rob a bank or good things like feed all the hungry people in the world, both your success at either will be determined by how well you learn to do that thing. So you can use it for good or you can use it for evil. I always say evil like a supervillain, and you shouldn't. But yes, and we're not taught this generic process that can make us all smarter. And we think it's, well, I'm just not that smart, or I don't have a math gene or something. And that's not it at all. In fact, I can tell you exactly why math is so hard, but maybe that's a discussion for another day.
So tell us, what got you into this? What's your story? In your bio that I was reading, it talked a lot about music, not about coaching at all. So what was it that you were originally in? And how did you get to this path?
I was coaching music. So that's how I got to the coaching thing and coaching learning. I have a master's degree in classical guitar performance. And before anyone turns off this off and says, it's just a dumb music teacher. We don't need it. If you only knew what really went into teaching music. Anyway, that's a whole other thing. Music requires performance. So as you would imagine, running a music program, as I did for many years, you have to get people to actually perform. The goal of all learning is performance. It's not to pass a test on algebra. It's to be able to do it when you're working on an architectural problem as an architect and do it quickly. One of the things, not sure exactly where this is at nowadays, but boy, oh boy, I remember having the multiplication tables drilled into my head. And boy, oh boy, is it helpful to have that now. So we need to be teaching things in that way so we can perform in the moment. Performance is the goal of all learning. Now, in most classes, it is the goal, but that's not really what students are. They're looking to pass a test, which is different. Now, given our system of education, it just is underfunded. We should really be evaluating project portfolios for every student that goes through all our, can't do it, don't have the money, done. So the system we have is probably the best system under the circumstances that we can have. We test basic knowledge. For instance, if you don't know what a stop sign is or what you should do at a stop sign, you should not be allowed to get in the car and drive it. So we have these basic knowledge tests where, geez, if you don't know what 2 + 2 is, if you don't know how to figure that out, you can't pass algebra. And so it works for the large scale kind of thing we want to do. But that's not performance. That's just what is called dipstick testing. How much do you know? Can you get through? And this kind of works. Because when we want to do something later in life, so you get through math and you get B's or whatever it is, then you decide you want to go into physics when you go to college. You have enough basics that when you put your nose to the grindstone to make up some of the stuff you didn't learn, you'll be fine. So the system kind of works. I was always tasked with getting people to perform, which is the ultimate goal. And the first thing I did is I spent the first, this, and when I finally started running a music program at a high school, I said, listen, I got to figure out what talent is, because I want to make sure I require of everyone what the most untalented person can do. Otherwise, it's unfair that I would be requiring of everyone what talented people can do. I spent 5 years looking for this and I couldn't find it. What I found was the amount and type of work, especially the type of work. In fact, most of us can do far less work and get far better grades or far better business results or far better at sports than we're doing now by understanding the things about learning that people just don't understand. And so the next 5 years, I remember this well, the next 5 years I spent, well, what are the things I can do? How does, if talent, whatever it may be, isn't what I thought it was, what can I do to make the most of these poor people who are looking to me to be able to perform this skill? And I started to run across things, little things here and there. I started to run across something called contextual interference, but I didn't know what it was. I just knew little bits and pieces. And this is kind of how we're taught, bits and pieces, tips and tricks. This, you know, does anyone remember Roy G. Biv? right? It's how we remember, right? It's how we remember the primary colors, red, orange, green, indigo, violet, blue, right? Or whatever. I'm sorry, I'm not getting it right. But why aren't we using these types of devices to memorize everything for all tests all the time? Why aren't we taught storage, encoding storage and retrieval as part of our study? And so I started to learn about this stuff little by little, but I didn't know what it was called. Then about 13 years ago, after just years of hard fought battles of trying to figure this out and trying to figure that out, like most teachers do, because they don't teach it in teacher education programs, how to get people to the ultimate goal of performance, I read a book which brought me to the science. I realized how powerful it was, and that's where I've spent the last 13 years of my life. And most of the research is not motor skill or music research. Most of the research is academic research. It all applies to learning music. And the same exact thing applies to math, science, football, baseball, theater, any study of scripture, anything.
Wow. So explain a little bit more than what the difference is between somebody studying for a test as opposed to somebody studying for the performance. Because in a way, that kind of sounds like the same thing. They're studying for the performance of that test. How well can they perform in that moment? So what's the difference there?
It is the same. Each is a performance, but one is a spot check of what is actually needed for performance. You are still performing the test. Yes, it is a performance. But that's just a spot check. Get someone to get an 85% on a math test and see if they can walk into an architectural meeting and do just the math that they've learned in the moment like this. That's the difference between actual performance and spot. And spot checking is fine. You have to do it. We train everyone that way. Doctors, pilots, lawyers, everybody that way. You have to know the content first and then perform. Go ahead, please.
What would you say is the gap then? Or is there a gap? Is there a needed course correction for somebody? Because I know several people who do brilliant performance, brilliant work in their jobs, know their stuff inside out. It's very easy for them. It's like they excel in it. But any kind of test, is they flop. It doesn't work. So what's the gap there in your experience?
This is a common misunderstanding by them, not you. This is a common misunderstanding. One area that I spend a lot of time coaching music in is at people who are at or near retirement age, who've accomplished a lot of really great stuff and can't figure out why they can't play one song beginning to end. How is it they can do this, but not even do the most basic of that? Got 5 hours. I could go through the whole thing and I have a lot of books you could read, but suffice to say, they don't know how they learned it. They just did it. So when we have people who perform so well, you've picked stuff up, things have been meaningful, things like deliberate practice, retrieval practice, contextual interference, those sorts of things we're all doing as part of the process, but we don't realize how we do it. And we don't realize how the learning process works. So just because we've gotten good at something, this is a common mistake. Just because someone's brilliant at something doesn't mean they're brilliant at teaching it. In fact, the likelihood is that they're not. In fact, just because this is a cultural misunderstanding, just because someone is brilliant at thing A doesn't mean they know any more than anyone else about thing B, C, and D. That's a common misconception that somehow we should listen to Einstein about music. Or he has some nice quotes about music, by the way. There, he played the violin. There is the difference. We don't really know how we learn. Nobody teaches us. Those that intuit it, but don't know how to express what they're doing, become very good at what they do. They try to help people by telling them what they do instead of what they did. That's a huge thing. If you want to become like they are, do what they did, not what they do. Don't go to some titan of industry and ask, what do you do? Ask, what did you do when you had the exact same amount of hours of focused practice that I have in this skill? Now, that sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? Okay, that's where a learning coach comes in. People don't know how to teach it. So that's the difference. There's a difference between getting good at something. And by the way, if you have people that have problems, I guess the best way to describe what you said, it could be very different, but hey, I got someone who can do really well, but they couldn't pass a basic test. That doesn't take very long. That's just a matter of memorization. And memorization can happen fast and accurately and with complete sure recall, no matter how much information it is. If you understand, I mean, I'm sure you've seen those things about the guy.
The guy. I have this fly that's flying around my face.
You've probably seen those things where like a guy is walking into a television studio and he's meeting everyone in line and then the show starts and he walks out and remembers everybody's name right after he meets them. Those types of things. That's not a particular skill that someone is born with. That is a learnable, trainable skill. And you can memorize as much information as you want in that way. It works the same way as everything else. You start out and you're slow at it and you have to work and understand. And then you get better at like tying your shoes. Then you get better and better and better and it becomes easy. So when you see the guy walking into the studio, he's going through a process that he's practiced thousands of times. If you'll practice it a few times, you can remember every single thing that's on the test. Every single thing without fail. In fact, that's what I do when I do my teacher workshops and professional development. First thing I do is I throw 8 numbers at them. Some of them are double digits. And I tell them how to memorize it using something a lot of people have heard of, the method of loci or the palace technique, whatever people like to call it. Then we do what nobody does, retrieval practice, test. Tests can be used 3 ways. Summative assessment, how much do you know at this point? Formative assessment, what do you know and what do you need to know? And the way it's never used for retrieval, for getting information out. And we don't practice getting information out. And that's the big problem. Besides the fact that we can't get it in very well. So we do retrieval every 10 minutes. I'm doing my lecture. I'm talking about science and all this other stuff. And then timer goes off. I say, everyone retrieve. By the way, if you do a retrieval and you get something wrong, something called the testing effect shows that you don't need any more practice. The next time you will be more likely to get that thing right. So getting stuff wrong is actually the pain, the burn, the blurn, feel the blurn is what I call it. I always keep this around, feel the burn of learning. And then we get to the end and I put up a multiple choice A through E question. And I say, okay, which one is it? And it's like D, right? So you got A, B, C, and then E is not that at all. I said, now, did you, and the first couple of numbers are always correct. And then it goes off something else. I said, did you read all the answer to A or to B? No. C? No. Did you read E at all? No. You knew what it was, didn't you? Yes. Yet, for instance, using testing anxiety as an example, we tell our kids, consider each question, think about it, come back to it later, see if you can find the answer. This becomes unnecessary when we do retrieval practice properly.
Yeah, very cool. So where would you say that the people are at when they actually are coming to you and they're needing their help? Are they more of, they're very aware of the self-esteem issues and they're wanting your help there? Or is it more on the spectrum of, I can't figure out how to get better grades or how to pass this test and then you take them over into the self-esteem?
Well, it's usually the second, what you just said. If we're getting into areas of therapy and psychology, that's not me. But it happens quite naturally. The self-esteem, this is where self-esteem really comes from. Knowing that one can do anything one wants to do and having the tools to be able to do it. Maybe we'll get to it later. Is this something, a study that came out about Gen Zers and how they behave and all this stuff? And I said, you know, somewhere around the 90s, there were some studies that came out that said self-esteem and good grades are correlated. And everyone said, hey, if we give our kids tons of self-esteem, they'll get good grades. And it didn't really work out that way. Turns out, good grades cause self-esteem, not the other way around. And so if you can get people to know their own power, there's research on this, it's very clear, getting better at something, even if you don't like that thing, getting better at that thing will make you like it and will make you want to do better. If we think about a lot of the things we don't like to do, they're the things that are harder to do. Well, there's an easy solution. Make it easier. And that's what love of learning is. I think a lot of us think that love of learning is just some really high ethical person who just loves consume. No, the love of learning is the love of understanding, of figuring things out. The brain loves figuring things out, and it makes you feel really, really good when you do it. And it doesn't matter what it is, whatever it is you want to learn. You can do this with kids in math, science, football, music, anything.
So it sounds like with all of this, that love of learning and the breakthrough moment and understanding the self-esteem along with the education part, that you really have your own story behind this. Like, I really want to know what that was for you and the challenges you had to overcome to unlock this.
Sure. That's actually a great question. Thanks. I don't think anyone has ever asked that like that before. Thank you. Like I said, I have a master's degree in classical guitar performance. I started playing out in bands like a lot of kids do. And I became kind of serious about it. Big fan of the Beatles. And I thought, hey, boy, you know, I thought erroneously, and thank goodness I thought that the way to make it in music is to write music as quality as the Beatles. That's not really the way you can put a hat on and dance. I mean, there's all sorts of crazy, we all know people get famous for all sorts of crazy stuff. But luckily I had this misunderstanding as a child. So I felt I needed to pursue being a quality musician, which led me to studying classical music in college. And I went all the way through a master's degree in performance. For those that don't know, that's different than music history, which is one area. That's different than music theory. That's different than composition. It's different than the music therapy. It's different. It's performing your instrument. That was the focus of all of, you know, all classes were, and I never got that good. I practiced my butt off. I worked so, not always, some years I didn't. Boy, if I only knew how learning worked, I would have done it. In fact, I was an incredibly poor student. I can see it in front of my eyes like it's yesterday. My third grade teacher on the last day of school walking out, I'm walking out of the classroom. She says, "You pass by the skin of your teeth."
Oh, man.
And it's not because I wasn't smart enough to pass. Hated doing the work. And if I would have only known how to be successful, it would have been different. So music, I fell in love with. I wanted to pursue it. I figure if I just do everything these people tell me, I'll figure it out. And I still couldn't. Then I got a job after graduate school, my first real job, running a music program at a high school out here in Anaheim, California. And I was now responsible not just for my learning, but for the learning of others, for the learning of high school kids who put their trust in me to teach them well. And that's what did it. And when I found it, I started using it on myself. And all of a sudden, I could play things I could never play before. All of a sudden, I could learn things that I could never learn before. And it was amazing. And that's what happened. I have been there. I have been the stupidest kid in the room. I have been the kid who fails tests, who is a problem kid, ADHD, if you couldn't tell, who fails stuff, who hated school. And now I understand, and this hurts, but now I understand that I could have loved it. I'm glad things turned out the way they did, because I don't know that I'd be able to help others had I not had these experiences, as regretful as they now are. But that, man, it's amazing how you zeroed in on that. You knew something happened. And that's what it was. I could never, ever, ever. And what do we usually think? We do poorly on a test. We don't perform something well. We go out and play running back for the football team and have a bad game. What do we think? I'll just keep doing what I do, but just more of it, and somehow get better.
No. Well, and I really appreciate that too, because that is very much what pushes society right now, is practice, 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 just keep doing it, just keep doing it. And while, yes, there's an element to that practice,
absolutely,
it doesn't do any good if you don't have what you call this love of learning. So can you explain a little bit of some of like the different thoughts that have shifted since when you hated school, when you weren't good at the instrument, no matter how much time you spent on it, and then when you love learning, the different kinds of experiences that you were having just inside your own head?
Yeah. And it's duplicatable for anyone. And it can be, and I teach it to people all the time. You may have heard of the concept, maybe not, of flow. There's a researcher named Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, spelled just like it sounds. Anyway, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, who's, have you ever Have you ever gotten to work on something, anything, it doesn't matter what it is, and you think 10 or 15 minutes went by and you look up and it's been 50 minutes or an hour?
Oh, yeah.
That's flow. And what he has come to discover, or what he has come to believe, and I am in line with him, is that the essence of self-esteem and happiness is being in flow. And he makes a distinction between enjoyment, which is being in flow, and pleasure, which is just lying on a beach or playing a video game. Make no mistake, we all need pleasure. We all need breaks. It's in the literature. They're called recovery periods. You cannot expect someone to just put their nose to the grindstone. Even if you have to do 2 hours of work, don't expect someone to do 2 hours of work in the learning phase. If you're in the performance phase, it's a little bit, if you're doing your job, if you're performing, that's different. But we shouldn't be doing this massed practice thing. It's just too much. So what you're talking about is flow. This idea that you're engrossed in learning, and the time just, you lose your sense of self, and you're enjoying yourself, and you're learning a ton. Now, what a lot of people will tell you, and I believe this for some time myself, that flow can only be attained if you've acquired a good deal of skill in something. So you can't have flow learning baseball until you learn a whole bunch of fundamentals about playing baseball. And that's true. However, there's a neuroscientist who says that too. And one of these days I'm going to give that guy a call, because there is one exception. And that is the basic application of deliberate practice, which is the foundation of all learning. I'll show you what that is. It's a three-step. There are whole books written on this, and I've never seen anyone being able to explain it in a way that people can use. This is what it looks like. You do something. You think about what you just did. Then you make a plan to try and make what you did better. Here's how most people work. We leave this out.
plan, do.
we just keep doing and doing and doing. What's interesting is this, now this isn't easy to teach at first, because if you ask someone to think about what they just did and how they could be better at it, they'll look at you like a deer in headlights.
Uh-huh.
And I say stuff like, weren't you right there? I saw you. Weren't you here when you did that? And you come to realize, oh my gosh, I don't pay attention to what I'm doing. This is related. Maybe some of your listeners have read the book, Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman, which is just amazing, Nobel Prize winning researcher. And he talks about the difference between, and it's a continuum, there's not two specific things, but the difference between fast thinking and slow thinking. Fast thinking is what we like to do all the time. The brain knows it is the most important organ in the body, and it wants to conserve energy. So it's going to use, it's not laziness, it's going to use as little energy as possible. I'll give you an example we're both familiar with. You walk into a door that says pull and you push it, even though it says pull right there on the door. That's how we get through most of life, not thinking. And it has to be that way. Think about how life would go if you had to think, okay, I'm going to put my right foot out now, and then I'm going to put my heel down first, and then my toe, and then I'm going to put my left foot. Now I'm walking. And which direction? We couldn't do that. We automatize everything. The problem we have is in automatizing the important things, and we have to stop. Called orienting selective attention, and it can be trained. It occurs in the prefrontal cortex of the brain. We are used to not doing that, and we have to force ourselves to do it. So when we first get into this area and we start thinking about what we're doing, even the smallest of things, I'll use music as an example. Whenever I would first start teaching this, especially to kids, I'd say, okay, play a couple notes. How was that? I don't know. Play it again and tell me. And then teaching with questions, guiding with questions instead of giving explicit answers. Explicit teaching is great. And see, people get into this, well, should we have people do projects, or should everything is right at the particular right time? So explicit teaching is important and it has a very important place. For what I'm talking about here is we're teaching inquiry. So What did you find? I don't know. Couldn't find it. Then I would start saying things. Did I ever say anything about maybe which part of your finger to use? Oh, yeah, the tip and not the... And then that starts happening. Then the light bulb starts going on. Oh, I saw this. And the scales fall from their eyes and they can start to see a bigger picture. This is the growing of a mental model. which is the essence of intelligence. If anyone's ever read Peak by Anders Ericsson, this is what he's talking about, mental representations. And that is where the love of learning is. The continuous, I'm never really there, but I figure something out, but then there's something else and I figure something out. And that's where that time melts off the clock when that happens to you.
Yeah. And I just think about these kids and like the difference that that's making in their lives, because it's so empowering to have a teacher instead of just give you all the answers when you say, I don't know, instead of being treated like an idiot for not knowing, to go through that inquiry step and really like start, okay, well, do it again. And now tell me. And just kind of a small example, my 5-year-old, he doesn't talk a whole lot. He didn't really talk until he was about 3. And I just kept doing that same kind of thing where I would ask him, well, tell me about your experience. Like, tell me what made you sad. How does that, or how are you feeling right now? And for the longest time, for years, it was always, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. And more now though, I can see him like putting the pieces together, and he can articulate some pretty amazing things at 5 years old. Right. And I'm like, holy cow, this is awesome.
Once it opens up, right?
Uh-huh. I mean, and there's still things, of course, he's a kid, and there's still times where he doesn't know how to put it all together, or he's just flustered with words, and he'll turn to one of his sisters and be like, you say it, I don't want to say it. But there's, like you were talking about earlier, we don't expect kids to learn Mozart or a study. I cannot think of the name right now.
Trigonometry.
Yeah. but we give them those little pieces of evidence that their brain can figure it out. They can do this. And so what are some of the results that you've seen in people's lives? How has this helped them, not just with their educational, but with their ability in other areas?
Hey, you're going to think I'm exaggerating, but the quote I got from one person is, it's not an exaggeration to say it is life-changing. It is really the final frontier, I think, in the world's culture, is genuinely trying to learn to find the best version of the truth that we can whenever we can, and to really learn about stuff, to understand cognitive bias, confirmation bias, all the kinds of biases that we may have, and then to learn. And that's really what happens. And I've seen people, literally, I've worked with kids who within 1 week raise their grade from D to A. Now, not cumulative, the yeah. weekly grade. Of course, there's no cumulative grade that's and it just comes from that sort of thing, from learning to focus. And the other thing is, and this is the real takeaway I hope everyone gets from this, it's not enough to tell especially a child, it's not enough to tell them once. Like you said, you kept asking and you kept asking and you kept asking. It's iterative. And I think a lot of times us adults, think, well, if we tell them, we gave them the information, they can choose to use it or not. That's not how learning works. That's how telling someone something works.
Yeah.
That's not teaching.
So how have you seen this? I mean, obviously, parents who are listening can use your coaching for their kids, for themselves. That's huge. But how have you seen this kind of model and thinking in your own life change how you parent and how you show up in your life?
It changed everything. And it took a while, even though I knew. Here, let me give you a great example. So the idea of mass repetition, right? Repeating something over and over to learn it, whether that's a riff on the violin, or it's 2 times 2 is 4, or it's, you know, the primary colors or whatever it is. This idea that we have to do this kind of thing over and over and over until we get it right. Ah, I lost my train of thought. I'm sorry. I just forgot. What was the question again?
The question was, how has this changed how you parent, how you show up in your own life now that you know this model?
I'm sorry. That's where I was. Thank you.
That's all right.
It's not enough to tell them once. And it's not enough to do the same thing over and over. This is the act of teaching, or the art of teaching. And I think we all need to learn how to teach, because I would think right after security, teaching is the most important job of a parent. Security includes food and, you know, all the things we need to get by. And then how well do we teach? And teaching is regarded in our culture as Well, if you know how to do something, you tell someone else how to do it, and that's teaching. And that's what's really changed for me. My ability to teach myself, I can do anything I want. It's just a matter of time. You know, I'd like to learn how to fly a plane, but that's going to, I don't care how well my learning process is, that's going to take a lot of time, and I just don't have time for that. But it's a whole different life when you look at stuff. I can't tell you how much I love picking up my instrument nowadays, because I always know when there's a problem, I can fix it. When there's a problem, you can fix it. That's probably the biggest difference. Knowing you have the tools, the self-efficacy of knowing you can do anything that you want.
That's incredible. And we're done on time, but I really want people to know how to be able to find you and where they can go to get your help.
Where's the best place? GregGoodhart.com. That's my website. If you want to get to stuff that's specifically academics, I sent a link and she'll share it with you. That's probably the best place to go. I've written a book on music practice, and I've started a book on general, you know, how this relates to general. So that, awesome. And if you want to read how it's done and all my writing about it, it's free on my website.
Oh, so cool. And yes, I will definitely include all of those in the show notes so people can find you. And what a game changer. If you're listening, definitely, even if you're not sure if it's what you're looking for, go check it out, because that will just initiate your learning process and figuring out if this is something you need. So such a good resource. And in next episode, I will dive into a little bit of these exact principles of how what Greg's talking about can help those of us who have struggled with trauma and abuse and those things. And this mental capacity is such a big piece in being able to really rise above those things as well. So definitely thank you, Greg, for joining us. Thank you, everybody, for being here. And we'll see you all next time. Thank you again for being a part of our podcast family and for the difference you are making right now in the world and in the walls of your own home. If you're wanting to support parents everywhere, you can do that by leaving a rate and review. This helps so many find connection and answers they are searching for. Also, don't forget to go to WandaHoward.com and get your own free parenting blueprint. I love you all, and we will see you next time.